Welcome to the Renegade Inc. podcast. This is the audio version of our weekly talk show hosted by Ross Ashcroft.
Welcome to Renegade Inc., the show which allows us to think differently. On the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis, politicians are again ignoring the drivers that caused the biggest financial meltdown since 1929. Contrary to political groupthink, it was actually excess private debt, not public debt, that brought the economy crashing down. But today, private debt is again raging, and nobody seems to want to address the issue. So on this show, we ask, what's stopping us talking about the taboo that is Britain's private debt problem? When there's too much private debt or credit in any financial system, and when it increases too quickly, it always leads to financial instability. It's the volume and pace in which credit grows which links the crashes in the roaring 1920s, the so-called Japanese economic miracle in the 1980s, the US crash in the early 2000s, and of course, the great financial crisis. Joining me to work out why we find it so hard to accept that private debt is the problem is the anthropologist and writer David Graeber and the former chairman of the now abolished Financial Services Authority, Lord Turner, who incidentally is also author of the book Between Debt and the Devil. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for coming by. David, let's start with you. You've found something you've been sleuthing about, and you found something which came out of the Office of Budget Responsibility when it comes to private debt. Mm-hmm. And you're sitting here resplendent in your T-shirt. Let me just have a quick look at it. I told you so, right? What are you telling us? Because you want to pin something at the door of the OBR so they can't, let's say, negate their responsibility in the future. Mm-hmm. What is it?
About 2 years ago, I wrote an article for The Guardian about predicting that there was going to be a major crisis in private debt. And at the time, the OBR figures weren't really predicting it. And it just seemed logic, the central logic of sectoral balance is that if you have austerity, if you're constantly cutting government debt and government deficits, eventually this will have an effect on increasing private debt. And this is kind of the great secret they don't want you to know. There's this kind of mystical formula where you're supposed to think that if the government balances its budget, well, you know, that's going to make it easier for us to balance ours. Sort of magical correspondence between the two. But in fact, they have an inverse relationship.
Well, explain that. Why do they have an inverse relationship? If the government balances its books, what happens to the public?
Well, it's quite simple if you think about it in very stark terms. Imagine there's just the government and you. If the government taxes you £100, it has £100 more and you have £100 less. Similarly, if it borrows money and spends, it's £100 in debt and there's £100 more floating around in the household economy. Well, ultimately, these things always balance. Essentially, if the government is taking more in and putting less out, there's less money in the household economy, people have to borrow more. So it just makes sense that austerity will actually mean that private debt levels will go up, and indeed that's what happened. If you look at the charts, if you look at 2015, what they were saying was they were predicting modest levels of modest deficit in the household sector. But they're also saying, well, you know, that's going to be offset because there's going to be a lot of corporate borrowing.
And what did you see that was alarming? Why have you called for a public inquiry?
When I was looking at the numbers, I noticed something else. Now, if you look at these diagrams, they mirror. That's a counting identity. They have to mirror. And sure enough, in the old chart and the new chart, you have exactly the same on the top as on the bottom, until you get up to the projections on this latest one. And if you look here, actually, they don't match. The numbers literally don't add up. So I talked to some of my friends who are economists, I talked to Steve Keen, I talked to some other people and said, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? Is this like actually not adding up here? And they said, oh yeah, that's right. Nobody had noticed it.
All right, what is it, Turner? You've got to, you're itching to say something.
Well,
conspiracy or cock-up?
Yeah, I'm 99% sure that this is a cock-up, not a conspiracy. It is odd, if these are the figures, that we're looking at sectoral balances that, you know, don't add up, because anybody who's taught in undergraduate economics, when they do national income accounting, that there are four sectors which, you know, have to balance to zero. I think the big picture of what's been going on
yep.
is that before 2007-08, not just in the UK, and I think it's important to get away from one country area, but to look at all the advanced economies together, private debt as a percent of GDP increased quite dramatically from about 50% of GDP in 1950 for all the advanced economies on average to 170% by 2008. Primarily, actually, in the household sector and commercial real estate, and primarily to buy property. That's where the big increase in debt was. That really put us in a position where, when we then had a financial crisis in 2008, there was so much debt around that a lot of people were trying to pay down that debt. Corporations were trying to pay down debt, households were trying to pay down debt, and that put the economy into recession. And in that recession, the only thing that kept the economy going were large fiscal deficits, right. because that's the only thing that's going to keep the economy going. At the core of the modern economy, we have had this sort of gradual increase.
Global economy, yeah, modern global economy.
Yeah. And it is very, very important to take a global point of view, because if you look at any one country, I mean, let me give you an example. Whenever you talk about debt in Germany and say, we've got a problem of an economy which is too dependent on the creation of private debt. Germans will say, well, not us. I mean, that may be your problem. That's not our problem. You know, we're good people who pay back our debts. But actually, the German economy has been as much driven by debts as everybody else's economy. It's just their debts in other countries.
Right.
Germany runs this huge current account surplus, right? It exports more than it imports to the extent of 9% of GDP.
Yes.
And before the crisis of 2008, that was only possible because of unsustainable debts being piled up in Spain, in Italy, in Ireland, etc.
Greece.
And since the crisis,
Greece.
It's only been kept going by this enormous debt explosion in China.
Right.
So at the core of the global economy, there are some really unresolved issues about our reliance on debt, and bluntly, economics, a lot of mainstream economics has not given us a good set of tools to understand that.
It was a very kind way of putting it.
Most crucially, it tends not to concentrate on where does debt and money come from, and that money is primarily created as a byproduct of debt. Mm-hmm. Most of the money or money equivalents that we have in a modern economy are because a bank lends you money, and in lending you money, it creates money. And that was well understood by economists before about the 1960s. And then something happens in the 1960s and 70s where we almost write money creation out of the economic textbooks. And modern economic textbooks do not give a really insightful account of where money comes from. It's almost, economics develops what some people call a physics envy. And the physics envy is a desire to write economics in a highly mathematical fashion. Some economists were guilty of taking reality out of their equations in order that they could have equations which elegantly solved something which the peer-reviewed academic journals said was brilliant. I mean, and that may seem a very odd thing to do, but, you know, intellectual processes are often driven by their own internal dynamic between what gets you rewarded as an academic, between the desire for elegant solutions per se, and if in the course of that you have to make assumptions up front which are clearly nonsensical, sometimes people do that.
But I think we also need to take into consideration the fact that that also happens in politics, that politicians find that certain formulas really work. You know, the austerity line seems to win votes. It's a sort of moral argument that I want to do something to pitch in. You know, I want to be able to, you know, sacrifice for the sake of our children, responsibility, balancing the budget. I have to balance my budget. Shouldn't the government do theirs? They found that work. So to some degree, economists who, you know, provide them numbers that seem to reinforce what they want to say anyway or are found to be effective, well, obviously will tend to be favored.
I think we have to be careful on this austerity debate. I mean, I think we've overdone austerity because I think that in the aftermath of this huge private debt creation, it was inevitable and necessary that we ran large public deficits in order to balance the economy. And I think, indeed, the failure to do that back in 1929 to 33 is one of the things that turned the crash of 29 into a complete, you know, political disaster, particularly in Europe. But one mustn't leap to the other end and say, there are no limits to what you can do on public expenditure, because the fact is you can create problems in an alternative fashion. If you were to simply end up with large deficits, and if you were to effectively what's called monetize that by the central bank supporting them, then under some conditions you can create excessive inflation which causes harm. I mean, that is what happened in Weimar in the early 1920s. And I think what happens here is that austerity gets confused by two or three ways that the argument is used. The fact that large public deficits can be overdone, they clearly can be overdone, then terrifies some people, because they then have to, how do you discipline it? How do you make sure that we run public deficits which are useful and not too much? In order to try and make that argument that they've got to be significant but not too much, people then latch on to simple analogies like the private budget. They're trying to make it work for the individual, because they're sort of terrified that that's the only argument somebody will understand. And if you didn't have that, it would run out of control. We have a problem here that the amount of money that can be created is limitless, right? It can be limitless created by governments running deficits and monetizing them. It can be limitlessly created by a private banking sector creating it. And we need ways of controlling intelligently both of these. The big problem we had before 2008 is that we had developed an ideology in which we thought that the public creation of money was uniquely evil and dangerous, and that the private creation of money was always be just fine, because however much money the private sector created, it would create the correct amount because it was the clever free market. We actually have to realise that both of these can be dangerous.
Contextually, let's just look at this graph, and it's a graph that we love on this show, and it's astonishing.
Yeah.
So look, we start in 1880, and this is UK private debt since that time. And Mrs. Thatcher comes to power, as we can see there, and look at that takeoff. Now, if you've got that amount of private debt, and we can, and this is why I surmise you're asking for a public inquiry.
I am, yes.
Because if you've got that amount of private debt on a graph that's frankly eye-watering, how are you going to start to get yourself out of that situation?
That is the point, that once you create all of that debt, and if you then start to do that deleveraging that you can see in the final bit of that chart, it coming down from about 200% to 170%. You can only do that if simultaneously you're allowing public debt to go up. I mean, if you had achieved that deleveraging without letting the public debt to go up, we would have just tanked the economy into a deep 1920s-style recession. But now we've got high public debt, and we've got to work out, well, what do you do about that? What's the appropriate approach to that? So the easy thing to say here is we should have been much more worried about the upswing of the cycle. And at the time, I think the great failing of economics was that this was perceived to be something of no particular importance. Now, the crucial thing to understand about this increase, let's be clear, by far the biggest proportion of this is lending against property. I mean, that's 90% of this story is lending against property. This is household mortgage debt and commercial real estate debt. But, that's what drives
this. But we live in a property-owning democracy.
We live in a property-owning democracy.
Quite what is democratic about lending huge amounts of money and overinflated house prices?
Well, the other thing is, it's one of these things where a little of something can be good and too much of something can be bad. In the early stages of this takeoff, what people thought they were doing was making it easy to extend a property-owning democracy because it was easy to get mortgage debt. And in the early stages of that process, that was probably right. Up to a point, the easy availability of mortgage debt enables somebody who does not come from a richer family to borrow money to buy a house. And easier mortgage debt in the 70s and 80s probably helped spread property owning. Ironically, what then happens is that when it becomes too easy, it actually undermines the growth of the property-owning democracy.
Well, both.
It undermines it. It undermines it because the sheer ease with which debt is available pushes house prices to such a level that only people who do have a parent who can, bank of mum and dad, can give them a deposit could possibly afford it. Which, by the way, I think relates to David's work on the long-term history of debt. If you look at the origins of extreme inequalities in society, we go back to agricultural societies, what you get is relatively small differences in things like luck, the luck of a harvest, the luck of whether your piece of land produced a good harvest or not, produce an environment where the richer farmer lends money to the poorer farmer, run it forward for six generations, and this guy's a feudal overlord, and that guy's a serf. You know, debt can, unless we're careful, generate a self-reinforcing inequality because it gives huge opportunities to the people who already have some wealth, which they can use to borrow money. And for people who don't have it, the interest rate goes up and it removes from them even the wealth that they've got.
David, wrap up the first half for us in view of this request for a public inquiry.
When the crash happened, everyone said, well, why didn't we see this coming? You know, and you could make the argument that they didn't have the tools at the time. They didn't understand the relation of private debt and financial instability and risk. But now they do.
Right, and this is what you...
That's why I'm calling for public inquiry. I mean, come on, we're not going to make the same mistake this time of our either.
That's it for this half. Join us after this short break for more from David Graeber and Lord Turner.
If you're enjoying this podcast, join us at renegadeinc.com.
Welcome back to Renegade Inc., the show that allows us to think differently. Before we talk more with David Graeber and Lord Turner, let's have a look at our favourite tweets in this week's Renegade Inc. Index. First up, we have a tweet from Jesse Colombo at The Bubble Bubble, so you can see where he's coming from. Yes, you should be concerned with consumer debt. And just for context, that graph starts in 1959 to present day. Next up is from Bloomberg. Tons of money is pouring into private debt. What could possibly go wrong? But at last, one of the bigger media players picking up that it could be an issue. Next from Dr. Enigma, between 1950 and 2007, advanced economies' private debt grew from 50 to 170% of GDP. Since 2008, debt has shifted from private to public sectors. And finally, from Existential Philosoph, we didn't lose the why, they decided to do that. Ironically, private debt builds up to a tipping point because Austerians are running around saying, we have to cut government spending. Our book of the week this week is Lord Turner's Between Debt and the Devil. And this is a perfect opportunity to say to you, pitch it to us.
I was chairman of the Financial Services Authority in 2008. I took over 5 days after Lehman Brothers collapsed.
That's called a hospital pass.
That was a hospital pass. You walk into a new job and the ceiling is collapsing on top of you. I had to spend autumn 2008, you know, with the governor of the Bank of England, with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, with colleagues around the world, working out how do we deal with this crisis. But from 2000 and on, a lot of us began to think, well, why has this occurred?
Right.
And why is recovery so difficult? And that's what this book is about. What is the fundamental drivers, rather than the sort of surface drivers, of why 2008 had occurred, but even more, why has it been so difficult to recover from?
It's all in here. We recommend it, and it's Between Debt and the Devil. One of the things that you courted a fair bit of controversy for is saying that the city in London is too big. Why do you think that?
What I said, and other people have said it, but it caught the imagination when I said it, I said some of these activities are socially useless, right?
Which ones?
Well, okay, there was a thing created before the crisis called a CDO squared. You take a whole load of mortgages, you divide them into tranches, which have different levels of risk and security, by which time it's so complex nobody can really understand.
And this is the physicist.
You sell these tranches to a whole load of investors who don't really understand what they're buying. And a CDO squared is a magic piece of sausage making where you take one of these tranches, which is the product of a tranching process, and you tranche it all over again, by which time nobody understands at all.
And everyone's got a migraine.
And what I said is, if in the course of the crisis we had managed to mislay the instructions on how to create a CDO squared, humanity would have been no worse off, and this was a socially useless activity. There is less of that activity going on at the moment. But unless we're very careful, they'll come back.
Should we celebrate the great financial crisis? Because we celebrate an awful lot of terrible things and commemorate, an awful lot of terrible things, not least war. And this was a big old economic war. It was a lot of people's quality of life has been significantly impacted. If there's ever an airline crash, we go through that black box and piece everything together again, absolutely meticulously as far as possible. The selective amnesia I'm sure lobbying has something to do with this, that comes with a financial crisis of the sort we've just been through, means it's almost baked into the system that's going to happen.
Well, again. I hope not. I spent 5 years of my life as chair of the major policy committee of what's called the International Financial Stability Board, and we were trying to work out what are the new rules that stop us doing this again. I would personally have liked those rules to be tougher than we introduced. But I think we did an okay-ish job within the financial system itself. I think at the moment it's far less likely to produce a crisis than it did in 2008. And I think it's difficult to address a crisis like 2008 and say you're going to have one analysis of it, like an analysis of an airline crash. Because actually, it's such a huge, complicated thing that you need lots of different reports. The US produced a couple of very good reports produced by the Senate committees, etc. You have to look at the totality of that and see whether we've understood enough. I think we've understood some of it. What is problematic is that the level of debt in the world is still too high, and that we really don't know how to deal with that, apart from to have interest rates close to zero.
Which is a disaster.
And I think they're going to go on being close to zero. And what that then tends to produce is asset price bubbles. It tends to feed through far faster to wealth increases for the already wealthy than to increases in income for the ordinary. That's the big issue. It's not so much the financial system itself which has got better. It's the role of debt within our economies.
You mentioned that banks are less likely to go bankrupt. Yeah. Do you think that the committees that you sat on and the organisations that you chaired have been too fire sector focused, and actually you haven't looked at man on the street and said, how do we help these people out?
The committees which I chaired did the job which was given to them by, you know, the institutions of the world. And I don't think...
Right, can you see the problem there?
No. I think there are a set of technical questions about why did 2008 occur? Why did banks go bankrupt? Why did Lehman's fail? How do we stop that happening again? How do we stop having that self-reinforcing past? And technically, we've addressed a lot of that. But sitting behind it, and it's part of a key theme of my book, there are some bigger issues about the way that capitalism isn't working for everybody. Now, that was way wider than the remit of my committee. And frankly, if I'd said, well, you know, you want to report G20 leaders on how we fix the financial system, but I'm not going to give you that. I'm going to give you a lecture on the whole of the capitalist system. They'd have probably said, well, thank you, Adair, much, but could you answer the question we asked you? And that's a reasonable thing to do in life. But we do need to answer these wider questions. You know, why has growth in income been so slow over the last 10 years? And in particular, why over a 30-year period are we getting such big increases in inequality? Why, of even the amount of growth that we got, does so much accrue to the top 1%? Why have the bottom quarter of American wage earners really not had a wage increase for 25 years? This breaks the sort of the compact of capitalism. I mean, everybody knows that capitalism is not going to have total equality, but the deal is, if it works, you know, at least everybody's making progress, and that deal has got broken, and that's, you know, that's fundamental, that we've got to address why.
Capitalism, David, in a couple of minutes, can you just sort it out?
It's unclear to me even if the system we have now should even be called capitalism, at least by many of the classical understandings of the term. It's largely based on rent seeking. Profits are largely not from investment in production or even commerce. You know, it's from the artificial production of debt. And the human costs of this are enormous. I mean, even if you compare Germany and the UK, two places which should be on roughly the same economic level, you know, wages have gone up something like 20% in real terms in Germany in the last, what is it, two decades or so. But, you know, during the same period, they went down effectively here. You know, we have nurses using food banks. We have, you know, poverty level life experiences for people who are working quite hard. And it's all completely unnecessary. And I think what we really need to understand about the rhetoric of austerity, it was a moral rhetoric much more than it was an economic one. It worked. It made people think that, you know, if you sacrifice now, this will mean your children or grandchildren will be richer. And you know, the terrible irony is not only is it not true, it might well be the opposite. You know, people's sacrifices actually are going to make their grandchildren poorer unless we do something about this very quickly.
We've covered a fair bit of the landscape, and then we talked a lot about private debt. So let's wrap up with this question, which is this. Why are we blind to it? Why is it so taboo?
We have this fantasy that economists do, that, you know, economy is a giant barter system. I think that a lot of people would be very uncomfortable of understanding this. A whole political rhetoric is based on the assumption that the economy works in a way that doesn't really work. And people don't want to rethink everything, especially when so many people have made so many sacrifices, real human sacrifices, in the name of a false understanding.
I think particularly in America before 2008, there was a political response to rising inequality, which didn't want to address fundamental issues like, are we equipping people with enough skills, or do we need to redistribute, or what are the fundamental causes? And which thought that it had got the magic answer, which is that as long as the financial system lent people with stagnant wages some money, they could buy houses, the houses would go up in value, and hey presto, people were getting wealthier even though their real wages were stagnant. It was a sort of let them ease credit.
A wealth effect.
And that came to an end in 2008 because it was bound to come to an end. But it was a response to, it was the only acceptable sort of response to inequality in an environment where we weren't addressing the more fundamental drivers of inequality. You can always temporarily attempt to deal with rising inequality by saying, well, let them have some credit to keep going. But in the long run, it won't work, and you'll increase inequality if you do that.
And you wake up to a banquet of consequences, as Mr. Stevenson said. Gentlemen, well, lastly, optimistic?
I think there are some major problems in the global economy which are unresolved. Good news was we'd learned enough that after 2009, we didn't produce the 1929 to 33. I mean, let's give us a little bit of credit. We did better than that generation. But there are unresolved problems that, you know, we still have to think hard about. And we've got to think hard about why capitalism, you know, is not delivering for everybody, which has something to do with this debt story. I think it also has some fundamental things to do with the way that modern technology works, which we really have to think about.
Optimistic? David?
I'm a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist. I think that something is brewing which is going to be a shock to the system. I think that it is possible the second time around people will make fundamental structural changes, and the sort of political stars are aligning in such a way I think that could happen. I think increasingly people are realizing that long-term visionary politics is required. In a way, there was this almost campaign against vision, against imagination, and I think we're realizing that we have no choice. We have to go back to some kind of vision of a different sort of economy.
That's it from Renegade Inc. HQ this week. You can drop the team a mail, studio@renegadeinc.com, or tweet us @RenegadeInc. We'd love to hear from you. Join us next week for more insight from those people who are thinking differently. But until then, stay curious.
Thank you for listening to the Renegade Inc. podcast. If you'd like to watch the episode or browse more of our content, you can find us at renegadeinc.com. Renegade Inc. was produced by Megan Ashcroft and Olivia Lebrun. Renegade Inc. is a Renegade Inc. production in association with Motherlode.